Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Marjorie Pabst, host of Caregiver and Physician Conversations, sponsored by eCareDiary.com. I'm the co-author of Enrich Your Caregiving Journey and, most recently, the author of a new book, Words of Care. You can find that on Amazon.com. The purpose of Caregiver and Physician Conversations is to provide practical information for caregivers, particularly on how you can have meaningful connections with doctors and with the medical community. And today is certainly no exception as we present part two of Caregivers and Healthcare Reform, What You Need to Know. Last month, we began with a series which provided the most up-to-date information and user-friendly resources for caregivers. And as you access this new health care law, more and more information will continue to come out about benefits for you and your family. So I'm so pleased to welcome back John Mills, who last month and now this month is going to be continuing to fill us in on the latest information. John is the co-founder of eCareDiary.com, which is sponsoring our show today and sponsors our show every Tuesday. John answered some key initial information last month, including what the law means for caregivers, how to begin accessing the Affordable Care Act information, and questions caregivers should be asking and answering for themselves and their families. Today we're going to delve deeper into that information in the new law and the implications and resources for caregivers, particularly pertaining to Medicare and Medicaid. And then John is also going to provide for us some additional internet-based resources. So you probably want to have a pen or a pencil handy to take some notes. And please, as always, do call us at 347-857-3399 with your questions. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Marjorie. It's a pleasure to be here.
I thought that the information about your background and the kind of experience you have with the Affordable Care Act and then others that preceded it was very interesting. And so would you recap that for us today, sort of what your history is with healthcare law in this country?
Okay, sure, I'd be happy to. Well, as we discussed in the last show, I have a long background in healthcare policy. I worked on Capitol Hill for 8.5 years, and part of that was during the Clinton healthcare reform effort. I was actually a member of the Clinton healthcare task force. Since leaving government and healthcare policy, I've worked in the private sector in a number of capacities, and I'm currently, in addition to co-founder of eCare Diary, I work for University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, their health plan, where I'm actually implementing a large piece of the Affordable Care Act around all the insurance reform changes.
Well, that's right. So you're right in the middle of it, and we're so lucky to have you on the program today. You know, during the last show, you explained some of the implications for those on Medicare, for caregivers and their loved ones. Would you recap your comments, particularly about Part D, the prescription provisions, for our listeners?
Certainly. So there are actually quite a few things in the Affordable Care Act that will benefit Medicare beneficiaries. And there's some changes in Medicare Part D that are going to be a big advantage for seniors. So I'm sure anyone who's in Medicare Part D is aware of the coverage gap, or sometimes it's affectionately known as the donut hole, where basically
right.
Starting at about $2,900, Medicare Part D stops covering your prescription drugs up to $4,700. It used to be that basically you got absolutely no coverage for your drugs in that coverage gap, which is almost $2,000. But starting in 2012, Medicare beneficiaries became responsible for only 50% of those costs. So basically Medicare started picking up half the costs in that coverage. And over the next decade, It will close down to a point where Medicare beneficiaries are only responsible for 25% of those costs. So this year, for example, it's 47.5% of the costs are what the Medicare beneficiaries are responsible for, and it will continue to go down at an incremental rate over the next 7 years till you get to the point where it's only 25% of the costs you'll have to cover when you're in that donut hole or coverage gap.
Yes, very. That's so useful for all of us. Are there other provisions, John, with Medicare that will provide seniors other things, additional things that it is not currently providing?
Well, it just started in, I believe it was 2011. There was zero-cost preventive care. So Medicare was originally founded as, I'm dating myself here, but was originally founded as what used to be known as sort of a major medical plan, where basically you had a upfront deductible before you got coverage for any services. And it's slowly surely been changing. But one of the last things to change in the law was to basically have zero-cost preventative care. And so when we're talking about zero-cost preventative care, we're talking about the fact that you can get your routine physical or colonoscopies, mammographies, pap smears, cholesterol screenings, et cetera, at no cost. So you won't have to meet the deductible, you won't have to pay a co-insurance, you won't even have to pay a copay. Those are now free of cost to all Medicare beneficiaries. And part of the reason that they're doing this is there's a lot of research that's been done over the years that people, particularly seniors, who get these services on a regular basis are far less likely to, come down with colon cancer or breast cancer, pap smears, because they catch things early. For example, with colon cancer, it begins as a polyp in your colon. So if they get the polyp out, you can basically at least stop that particular polyp from becoming cancerous. So it's those types of things that these preventive care benefits are designed to prevent.
Yes. And you know, that makes so much sense, doesn't it? It makes inimitable sense to prevent things before they happen. And, you know, as you were saying that, I was just thinking that, and when an older or any of us go to the doctor, an older person too, that you're not just getting that screening, but more than likely your doctor may be prescribing or looking at your weight, for example, and maybe suggesting different dietary, requirements for you. So there are other things that I would think we would all be aware of if we go in regularly for tests. We're going to be a little more aware of other things in our lives that we should be doing health-wise that we can prevent. So it all makes sense.
It absolutely does, and not only does it allow the Medicare beneficiary to live a healthier and more productive life, it's also very cost-effective for the Medicare program. So, a colonoscopy costs a couple hundred dollars, but if you end up with colon cancer, it's tens of thousands of dollars for the surgery and treatment. So it's sort of one of those, not only does it make your quality of life better, it also saves a lot of money on the back end.
Yeah, it's a win-win, I guess.
It's a total win-win.
So, let's turn to Medicaid and some of the things that the law provides. It will expand Medicare eligibility. So tell us about that.
Okay, so this is actually a very interesting part of the Supreme Court case that gets very little discussion. So when the law was challenged, and back last June, the Supreme Court upheld the individual mandate and the rest of the law. It actually struck down a section of the law, which was the Medicaid expansion. And the reason for that was that the way the law was originally written, states were required to expand Medicaid eligibility from 100% of poverty level, which is the current rules, to 138% of the poverty level. If they did not do so, they lost all of their Medicaid funds. and the states actually challenged this law in court. And I have to admit, as a former congressional staffer, because I was a little surprised that the court actually agreed with the states, because generally in the past, Congress has been pretty unrestricted in basically saying how money can and can't be used when it's giving grants to states. And Medicaid, I should probably back up and say, is a dually funded program. It's mainly funded by the federal government, but it does require states to put some matching dollars in. And that's based on state income. So states that are considered wealthier, New York, California, they have 50-50 matches with the federal government, but states that are poorer, so for example, Mississippi, which I think is the poorest state in the nation, they only have to put in 18% of the cost. And the reason I'm going into this detail is that when they struck this down, they basically said that while it's legal for Medicaid to be expanded to 138% of the poverty level, states need to have the option to opt into this. You can't basically say they'll lose all their Medicaid funding for all the other Medicaid programs if they don't opt in.
Yeah.
And so what has been happening on a state-by-state basis is states have been deciding this year whether or not they want to expand Medicaid to 138% of the poverty level. Most states are actually opting in. The federal government does cover 100% of that expansion for the first 3 years and then phases it down over the next three to 90%. So it's a pretty good deal for most states. But this is a big this has been a sort of something that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but is a big part of the law. And
yes, yes. And so I'm assuming you would recommend that you check whatever state you're listening from today and that you're a resident of, to check into what your state is doing with respect to this Medicaid eligibility.
Yes, absolutely. And here's why this expansion to 138% of poverty is important. If you think you may be eligible for insurance coverage through it in January of 2014, it's important because Medicaid benefits tend to be more generous than what will end up being what we're calling the subsidized commercial policies. So, for example, most Medicaid insurance policies have very little or no cost sharing at the doctor's office. They also don't require the payment of premiums. And so people who fall into that 100 to 138% bucket, they don't make a lot of money. You're talking people that make between $11,000 and $15,000 a year. And so even having to pay $5 or $10 at the doctor's office, which to most people doesn't seem like a lot of money, to them is a lot of money. These are people who really live on the margins. So if you're in that income category, and come October when open enrollment's going to begin for the healthcare reform law, if you think you may be eligible, you want to find out if your state has opted to expand Medicaid, because it's a much better deal for you if they have.
Great. That is a really important and incredibly clear explanation, and thank you so much for that. You know, John, I've also heard, and I know there isn't like a lot of detail on this yet, that the new law will expand provisions for long-term care to community-based settings. What, if anything, do you know about that at this point?
There are four major provisions in the law that are really designed to expand long-term care to community-based settings. And this is actually a really big deal, because the way when they originally, you got to remember, Medicaid is almost a 50-year-old law now. It was passed in 1965 originally. And at that time, you know, most people got long-term care in nursing homes, if at all. But obviously since then we've become more sophisticated in the way we provide these services, and there are all sorts of home-based programs that didn't really exist in those days. But one of the problems with the law prior to the Affordable Care Act was that under the Medicaid law, there are certain benefits that states have to offer. One of them is nursing home care. However, home care was always was considered an optional benefit, so mm-hmm. states could offer it and get a match from the federal government, but they weren't required to. What tended to happen with home care was that these optional benefits, when states, like we just went through a very bad recession, but you know, states tend to have budgetary issues there. Mm-hmm. They look to save money. And obviously, even if the federal government is matching 50% of those costs, it's still 50% that they're picking up. They would cut those benefits that were not mandated by Medicaid. So there was sort of a yo-yo effect with a lot of these home-based services in states that chose to offer them. Yeah. The law has made a bunch of changes now where that should be eliminated, hopefully, where you won't have the situation where when states are flush with cash, they're offering home-based long-term care services and then cutting them back when recessions hit.
Yeah.
And probably the biggest program to eliminate this sort of yo-yo effect is what's called a home and community-based services waiver program. And what this is it allows states to come in and develop innovative home-based and community services program and offer them as an alternative for skilled nursing care, except for people who absolutely have to be cared for in a nursing home.
Yeah.
And by offering them this demonstration waiver, the states, in effect, it becomes part of the mandated program that the state provides every year, and that way they don't have to worry. You don't get into this yo-yo effect where you're cutting it back because it becomes part of your mandated Medicaid benefit to beneficiaries. And this is really great for a host of reasons. Home and community-based services are, first of all, they're much less expensive than caring for someone in a nursing home.
Absolutely.
And secondly, they're better for most of the people who receive them. The people are happier when they're at home.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be more active. They tend to be healthier. And mm-hmm. so for all those reasons, this is really good news. And it's finally a sign that Medicaid's starting to catch up to what's been happening, frankly, outside of government programs for many years.
That's really terrific. And, yeah. You know, that is such a bright light in this new care law. For our listeners, we are going to have another show. It will be a few months from now. And we're going to have a physician from the American College of Physicians who will, we hope by that time, detail some of these options for communities, so some of the ways that communities are beginning to put in place these home and community-based waiver programs. And so we'll keep you informed as we get the information, right, John?
Yes. There's actually one other, there are a number of them, but there's one other that I do want to point out. And mm-hmm. when we have our show on this, we can spend you could spend more than one show on this. There's a lot of information.
Yeah.
But there's another demonstration program in the law called Money Follows the Person. So, and it's almost exactly what it sounds like, which is basically for people who are currently in institutions but are there largely because they're trying to take advantage of Medicaid,
mm-hmm.
but could live in a home-based setting. Basically, the money follows them. So if you basically take someone out of a nursing home and put them into a community-based setting where if it's safe for them to be there, the money will follow them. So they don't have to worry about reapplying and or losing their Medicaid eligibility.
Terrific. That is terrific and good news.
Yes.
And more, we hope good news is coming down the line with respect to this particular area of long-term care in community. Last time, you raised, when I asked the question, well, what should caregivers What kinds of questions should caregivers always have at the ready in terms of keeping on top of the law and themselves and their families? And you mentioned three absolutely critical questions that we want to build upon in this next section. The first, John, that you mentioned was just get in touch with your needs. We need to ask yourself, what are my needs as a caregiver? What are my loved ones' needs, my family's needs? So that you go into looking at this healthcare information from the base of what are my needs and not trying to get me more coverage than you actually need. And then you mentioned a question about the cost-benefit of the insurance related to those needs. And then you brought up a question about the threshold. And quite frankly, I can't remember exactly what you said about that. So I want you to remind me and our listeners about that.
I'd be happy to. So under the law, depending on your income, you're eligible for assistance to pay for your health insurance premiums. So when I was talking about the threshold, I'm talking about that threshold. So if you're under 400% of the poverty level, you are eligible for what's called a refundable tax credit that will basically be used to pay for your insurance, help pay for your insurance premiums every month. It's on a sliding scale based on your income. To give you an idea of how much 400% of the poverty level is, it's about a little over $40,000 per year. The most generous benefits are for people below 250% of the poverty level, and that's about $26,000 per year. So it does phase out as you go up the income scale, but those are very important things. So if you come October when open enrollment starts for the healthcare reform law, if you have an income under $46,000 per year, you should be asking whether or not you're eligible for a refundable premium tax credit to pay for your health insurance. If you are, what will happen is actually it will go directly to the insurer you choose, and you will just receive a bill from the insurer for the difference between whatever that tax credit is and your premium.
Great, great. I'm going to stop right here and just double check and see if we have anybody on the line today for John. Our number again is 347-857-3399. Is there anyone out there today who has a question? Okay. Well, if not, I wanted to ask you, John, if we could dig deeper into some of these questions and if you would share with us any additional questions that you would suggest for caregivers that they be thinking about as they approach this healthcare law and what it means for them.
Absolutely. Well, I think people are going to have a lot of choices, and while there will be tools and people as well, phone lines as well as in-person ability for people to choose their health benefits, some of the things you should be thinking about is if you have a doctor, is your doctor in the network? So you'll be able to check that online, or if you were to call the 800 number or to meet with, they're going to have these people, they're called navigators, you can sit down with them in person. They'll be able to tell you. If you don't have a doctor, you're going to find that some plans have very, very large networks where they'll have, every doctor and hospital in the area in them, and some that may have smaller networks that may exclude some. To be very honest, the smaller networks will probably be less expensive, and if you feel comfortable with the doctors and hospitals that are in those networks, then you should feel free to sign up for them. I think the other thing that I would be looking at as well is sort of your, it's almost what I would say, your tolerance for risk. So how much are you willing to pay out of pocket for services versus your monthly premium? So not surprisingly, if you pick a health insurance plan that has very low out-of-pocket costs at the doctor's office, it's going to have a much higher premium. If you pick a plan that has much lower out-of-pocket costs at the doctor's office, it's going to have a lower premium. So these are the types of things you'll need to be thinking about. And it can get very complicated. That's why there will be people there to help walk you through all of this.
Yes, yes. Well, that's great. Terrific information. We have just a couple minutes left, and we did promise our listeners we would give any additional internet resource information. Last time you mentioned the Kaiser Family Foundation as a terrific resource. Do you have any others for us today, John?
I do. I'm going to give two websites out that have some very good information. One is Medicare.gov. So if you're a Medicare beneficiary, you should go to that website. It has great information about the Medicare program, and so I would advise going there. And then the other is CMS.gov, and this is the website that is going to be doing most of the healthcare reform. There's a lot of healthcare reform information there. Actually, there's a third website. It's actually called healthcare.gov. So these are all government websites. They've got very good information on them about either Medicare, healthcare, and healthcare reform.
Wonderful. Just great. And thank you so very much for all of this fabulous information. We'll make sure we get these internet resources on the eCare Diary website for all of you. And I want to thank all of our listeners today. I want to remind everyone to tune in again next week when Ellen Belk will be appearing on our Empowering Caregivers show, which happens every Tuesday. She is the president of an organization called Keep In Mind, and she develops innovative products for the memory impaired. So I know you'll want to tune in for that. Again, this is Margie Pabst with eCareDiary.com, thanking John Mills, the co-founder of eCareDiary.com. Hope you all have a wonderful day. Goodbye.